Welcome to Women in Venture Capital. I'm Rushvina, Chief of Staff at General Catalyst, with prior experience in finance and early stage VC.
And I'm Anvita, Senior Product Manager at UiPath with experiences across tech startups and venture capital. Our mission at Women in Venture Capital is simple: increase the representation of women in the VC industry through awareness and engagement.
So join us as we engage with women, establishing their presence in the industry. Our guest today is Heidi Rosen. Heidi is a partner at Threshold Ventures, an early stage VC focused on healthcare and enterprise software. Heidi has served on over 40 boards, both public and private, and currently serves on private company boards for Polar and Upside Foods, as well as public company Planet Labs. Prior to Threshold, Heidi was a partner at DFJ and at Mobius Venture Capital. She started her career as a co-founder of software company TeaMaker and served as its CEO for over a dozen years until its acquisitions by Delux Corporation. Heidi holds a bachelor's and an MBA degree from Stanford. Heidi, it is such a special moment for us. Thank you so much for joining us on the show.
I'm so glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
So, you know, I talked about your journey and you were one of the early founders, I would say early female founders in the 90s. And you're not only a classic operator turned VC, but you co-founded one of the earlier software companies, TeaMaker. Can you tell us a little bit more about building and growing that company for over a decade? And
sure.
What were some of your biggest learnings?
Sure. I mean, you know, in many ways, even though that now we incorporated that company 40 years ago this last summer. So that's a long time. That's a lot of history. And I think in many ways, there's not that much difference between starting a company today and starting it back then. You had to have a good idea. You had to have the ability to execute it. You had to have a lot of tenacity. You had to seek product market fit. You had competition that you had to fight. And so many of the elements are the same. Of course, the personal computer industry at that time was a really tiny, nascent industry. And so there weren't that many people pursuing it. A lot of them were based here in Silicon Valley and you know, obviously some in Seattle. They did pretty okay, too. You know, many of the things were the same. I mean, some of it was very different. One of the things that I joke about on my, I have this podcast, and I was just working on an episode this week about something that has to do with the early days, because I co-founded the company with my brother. And so I just was working on a podcast episode about working with family. And so I was talking about some of those early days. And one of the funny things, of course, back then is software was a physical product, right? You put it on a disk and you shipped it in a box. And so you had to worry about all the physical distribution elements too, and obsolescence and, you know, your supply chain and a lot of stuff that nowadays, thankfully, people who create software companies don't have to worry about any of that. But, you know, many of the elements were the same. And I think that's what makes operating people like me hopefully still valuable, even after decades and decades, is people issues are kind of the same. You know, people just haven't changed that much. they still are, you know, people first and their jobs second. They still want to have job satisfaction. They want to be treated fairly. They want to make meaningful contributions. They want to have some fun. They want to do well financially. I don't know, you know, people, they have conflict when they don't agree with other people, and they don't always see the other person's side of things. And I don't know, you know, I think so much of business is actually dealing with people and people issues. And so that's where I feel like 40 years of history probably gives me a lot of insight into people issues.
I think it definitely does as well, Heidi. And I think you're right. Like, one of the things one of the founders I was speaking to mentioned, which stuck with me, was after a point, maybe a couple of years into the journey from after the 0 to 1 phase of a startup, the actual role of a CEO remains to be the head of HR in the most scenario.
Yeah.
And you rightly pointed out that it becomes about managing people, retaining them, having new ones join and onboard and orient, etc. So yeah, you're right. Like, all of it is very much transferable and makes you...
And you're bringing up something I think really interesting that I've also been spending some time thinking about, is the founder dilemma. And the founder dilemma is, you know, normally when you start a company, as my brother did, by the way, he was the brilliant programmer, not me. You start a company and you start it because, for at least in the tech industry, because you yourself are often a technologist and you see a way to solve a problem using technology and you create that. And so very often you're the inventor, you're the coder, you're the person building the product. And then if you're lucky enough that your company is successful, as the company grows and grows and grows and grows, you get farther and farther removed from your core competency and your passion, which was product development. And you become the chief fundraiser, you become the chief HR person, you become the resolver of conflict, you spend a lot of time hiring people, fundraising, sorts of things that in fact, many founders don't even like to do. And sure. So it's a really interesting and I think worth exploring is, as a founder, do you have to be the CEO? And of course, if we look out there, we can see many examples of people who were and many examples of people who weren't. And mm-hmm. you can find successes and failures in both of those sets of data. So I think it's just an interesting, it's another interesting thing to think about when you're founding a company. And to check in with yourself every year or so, if not more frequently, is, am I doing the job that I want to do? Am I using myself as the best resource for the company? Because presumably, if you're a founder, you want to see the company be successful. And so objectively, you shouldn't necessarily give yourself the CEO job if you're not the best person to be in that role.
True. Makes so much sense, Heidi. And I completely agree. And going back to what you were saying, most of these skills remain transferable. Like even if, like you said, your business was started about a few years back, maybe a couple of decades or more, yes. Most of these skills are very much transferable. The core of a founder remains what it is. And with that, I think, as Rashmina was mentioning in the intro, we know that you transitioned from an operator to a VC. Very curious to hear on how you decided on that transition, particularly also why you decided to join Threshold. Can you share more about the fund's investment strategy as well?
Sure, absolutely. Well, I'll talk about the transition, then I'll talk about Threshold. For me, the transition was simply that, you know, I was in the entrepreneur seat for more than a decade. Never do you have higher highs or lower lows than when you're an entrepreneur. And after, 14 years of that, including the time after we sold the company, I was still working for the acquirer. I had two kids at that point. I went to Apple for a year. After I served out my time at the acquirer, I went to Apple for a year and I thought, maybe it'd be fun to work for a really big company. And that was not for me. I mean, it was really just not something I enjoyed. Meanwhile, I had, a 1-year-old and a 3-year-old, and I thought, I'm never seeing my kids because I'm at work all the time. And so I decided to take some time off. And that's when I got recruited into venture. So the thing that attracted me to venture, and somewhat mistakenly probably, but at the time I thought this was the way it worked, is that I could have the fun and joy of entrepreneurship without being in the driver's seat, right? So I could work with other people who were entrepreneurs and I could help them build their companies and I could counsel them from the sidelines, but I didn't have to work that hard. Well, that didn't have to work that hard part is not completely true. VCs, most VCs I know are really busy, and they're really busy because they're looking for deals. They're looking for opportunity and they're working with their portfolio companies. And so again, I would never say that a VC has a harder job than an entrepreneur because they don't. I've been both and I guarantee that is true. But I would also say that doesn't mean you're sitting around in your bedroom slippers not doing anything all day long. And so I got recruited into, actually it was SoftBank Ventures at the time in 1999, which is either the best time or the worst time to become a VC, because my first two deals went public within a year at 10Xs and all that stuff. And then the dot-com bust happened. And then I spent years working out of the misery of what happens when a market cycle turns that negative. Which was a great learning experience. But I love venture. I do love venture because I do find that, they say in venture, you have to be a good hunter and you have to be a good farmer. So hunting obviously is getting the deals, and then farming is once you have the deal, working on the deal. I truly love being a farmer. That is my thing I love the most. And so what I really enjoyed about my role at Threshold is I am not on the front lines of doing deals. I am on the front lines of helping deals we already have. And so for me, I love that because I can be collaborative. I am not judging the entrepreneurs. I am working with them to try to make their companies successful. And, you know, some of these relationships go on 5, 6, 7 years. I mean, they are long-term relationships and you do become part of the team. But at the end of the day, I joke about it. I'm not a grandparent yet, but I joke about it being maybe a little like grandparenting. You know, it's not your baby. It's still someone else's baby. And when you have to stay up all night because the baby's sick, you're not the one staying up. They're the one staying up. So I really enjoy the work. And I love to see entrepreneurs be successful. I'm rooting for them on the sidelines and behind the scenes. And sometimes I'm delivering things they don't want to hear. You know, sometimes I'm telling them that the plan, their plans are unrealistic, or their fundraise is not going to work the way they think, or their whatever. You know, I try to be the voice of measured and experienced truth, even if that truth is sometimes difficult to take. And obviously for me too, I'm learning all the time. I mean, as I said, many of these things are, you know, history repeats itself, patterns repeat themselves, but there's always new things all the time. And I think we're about to be in this huge crush of new thing called AI. But anyway, as for Threshold, you know, I've been with Threshold now since the beginning of Threshold, and before that with DFJ, the place where Threshold spun out of. And so I've been there 12 years now. And, you know, really what attracted me to that group of people, and the same people that I work with today, they all have the same attitude that I have about we work in service to the entrepreneur. We are there to support the entrepreneur. And that doesn't mean pandering to the entrepreneur. That doesn't mean always saying what they want to hear. It means helping them be successful. And we operate at the Series A level. So we like to say to the entrepreneur, you know, we're way down on the cap table where you are. We're as close to common as it gets, usually, especially in markets like these where you start to get stack preferences and things like that. We really are aligned with the entrepreneur. We also don't have giant funds. The current fund is $375 million. And so, you know, you're putting 10, 15 million per deal. You can't suddenly write a $50 million check to control and save a company. You are counting on the entrepreneur being able to raise additional capital from new investors, not from continuing to come back to us. And so we feel we're very, very aligned with the entrepreneur, and we feel very strongly that that's what you do. You do the right thing. You never try to unfairly capitalize on a situation, and you build your reputation over time, and you generate your returns over time. And the focus of the partnership is on really two bigger sectors, on healthcare and on enterprise, and primarily enterprise SaaS. And, you know, that's enough to keep us busy. There's a lot going on in both of those spaces right now. And so it's really fun to see that. And then it's really fun to be helpful to companies. I mean, I'm right after this discussion, I'm heading over to the East Bay, where I'm on the board of a company called Upside Foods that is developing cell-based meat. So real meat from animals, but you don't kill the animals to get the meat. At super fascinated company, has raised a lot of money because this is really hard to do, making great progress and super exciting team, really amazing. Actually, you know, interestingly, people came, even though it's a food company, the genesis is a lot out of healthcare because it is, at the end of the day, it's you know, it's biological processes. So very interesting company. And so having a great time. So I really love my partnership. Really love the companies that I get to work with. And then the partnership also has me working with Stanford. We have a fellowship program there that I run. So I'm also an adjunct faculty at Stanford and teach that program. So my partners asked me last year, you know, if I could codify all the things that I've learned over these 40 years and put them into bite-sized pieces for entrepreneurs to digest when needed. And so I started a podcast. It's called The Startup Solution. And my goal is short, actionable insights around things that entrepreneurs really deal with. So I deal with everything from how to get rid of a bad board member, how to not have your board blow up at you. I've talked about down rounds. I've talked about should you let your family invest. I just recorded one yesterday on working with family, which I have a lot of experience doing myself. And so it's really fun. We come out with something about every 2 weeks and we try to tackle an issue, you know, carve outs, secondary sales. It really is all over the map. And in fact, I encourage anybody who listens to it, please send me ideas or questions, because I love tackling, you know, I always live in fear when you have a podcast that you're going to run out of content. And then thank God, there's always something interesting that someone ends up asking me that gives me new fodder for new material. So I'm getting a lot of questions about governance right now. Can my board fire me?
Interesting. Yeah. I will definitely be recommending your podcast to founders that I interact with. These are so many common themes and questions that you brought up. I thought it was really interesting how you talked about the farmer persona within VC. I think for the longest time, it was very hunter oriented, and it was usually, you know, you had funds dedicated to providing support to founders like a YC, or you had to be a large multi-stage fund to have a platform team. And I think we're seeing an increasing trend of platform or ops teams within VCs, even smaller funds. Yep. Because there is truth to the fact that, you know, this is, you want to build a strong relationship with the founder. You want to be there as they're growing the company, and they need you a lot, actually. Mm-hmm. So that was really interesting. Thank you for sharing that. And I want to double click a little bit more about, you know, you have a exciting board meeting to go to, and I want to talk about some of the innovations and trends that you're most excited about as an investor.
Sure. Well, I mean, I think the big one right now is AI, and how do you apply AI to things? I think, anyone who's not looking at that is foolish. and you know, on the other hand, I do think with anything like this, there's always a hype cycle. And you end up in a situation where people say, oh my God, it's going to change everything and everything's going to be different and everybody who's currently exists is dead. And then the reality is somewhere in between, where what really happens is the smartest entrepreneurs look at it as a new tool and figure out, how do I integrate this tool into what I already do to make me even better? And so on the one hand, I would tell you, if you are not a software entrepreneur and you are not seriously looking at AI, I think you're making a mistake. On the flip side, if you are a software entrepreneur, you're not going to die just because AI exists. AI is a tool. AI is a tool just like prior tools, whether that was, you know, the internet or multimedia or mobile or
the cloud,
you know, really. User interfaces going way back. You know, there's all sorts of developments that happen in technology, and the smartest entrepreneurs just look at it as, wow, there's another tool I can capitalize on. So I'm very excited to see how AI plays out in terms of, you know, everything from, you know, as I said, we do a lot in healthcare. I think diagnosis is such an interesting category for AI, but you still need a human in the loop, right? You still, at the end of the day, you're not eliminating humans, you're augmenting humans. And that's where I think there's a lot of excitement, whether that's healthcare, whether that's in enterprise, content creation, you know, you name it. I think we're just at such an interesting place that it's exciting.
Very true. And thanks for sharing. Switching gears a little bit, we mentioned in the beginning that this is one of the special episodes. And the core reason why it's special for both of us is that we did a case on you at HBS, the Heidi Rosen case, very memorable. And we did it for a few reasons. Like, the case talks about how you've built a strong personal and professional network around yourself, and then how you leverage that network for yourself and others. Would love to hear from you on what it takes to build a network like yours in this ecosystem, and how that has helped you in the VC environment overall specifically.
Sure. And I'll take a step back. I mean, that case is now over 20 years old, and it's amazing to me. It's still taught everywhere.
And it's a classic.
I find out memorable one. Like, I'll get like 100 LinkedIn requests from one school, and then I'll know that it's taught there this week. So I think the thing that makes the case evergreen is most cases are, here's a business decision, what would you decide? But my case is really, here's a philosophy of life that you can apply. And so I think that the idea, and perhaps this is because I was, you know, I came of age in the age of Wolf of Wall Street and, you know, greed is good and all that stuff. And everything was very transactional. And I think that my own philosophy is I like to lead a life that is very relationship driven. I think it is better for business. I think it is better for your soul. I think it's better for your family. And so instead of thinking of everything as a transaction, I think of everything as the basis of a relationship. And the interesting thing is, especially in tech and now in venture, you run into the same people over and over and over again. And so you really do, your ability to work and to contribute ends up having a lot of basis in your relationships and your reputation. And so it turns out that actually, you know, living well turns out to be good business too. So that really is my philosophy. My underlying philosophy is, you know, treat everyone with respect, try to find the maximum intersectional mutual need, try to do good for other people. And that doesn't mean that sometimes things don't work. I mean, sometimes you have to say no. Sometimes you have to shut something down. Sometimes you have to, you know, admit something didn't work. But at the end of the day, if you go in with a set of beliefs that that you can always find some good in a relationship, that the relationship is more important than any individual transaction, that people assume, I assume for most people, good intent, and try to operate in that way and try to always leave the door open for more and for doing more for each other. I just think it's a good way to live, but it turns out that actually works very well for the business I'm in as well.
That is so interesting. And I remember reading that case and I remember thinking at the time, I have to get to a point in my life where I get invited by Heidi to one of those gatherings. I want to stay on that case. I think because we're going to touch a little bit on bias in the industry. Mm-hmm. So Columbia University used the Heidi Rosen case and they did an experiment with it. They changed the protagonist, you, to Howard. And the feedback was eye-opening for some people, but sadly expected for a lot of people as well. While students thought both Howard and Heidi were equally competent, they found that Heidi was, quote, less humble and more power-hungry and self-promoting than Howard. Mm-hmm. Do you think these double standards towards women have or are changing at all?
So I think, I mean, there are a couple of things. I mean, it is a fascinating case. And I found out about it in a really funny way. So Professor Flynn, who did the study when he was at Columbia, then he was teaching at Haas at Berkeley. And my nephew was in his class. And my nephew has the same last name. And so he said, are you related to Heidi Rosen? And my nephew said, yep. And he said, oh, I did this interesting study. And so that's how I found out about it. And then I told Sheryl Sandberg about it when she was writing Lean In. And then she put it in the book. And then, of course, that blew up. And so it is very funny. My micro celebrity status as the poster child of subtle gender bias. But but anyway, it's always funny how those things happen, right? How they become this larger than life thing that started in a small way. But I think it's fascinating. I mean, I do think biases exist. I do think that it is true that women are expected societally still to be more self-deprecating, more collaborative, less pushy, less bossy, all those things. And so I don't know, you know, I have a funny theory about that study is in the case when Frank Flynn did the Heidi Howard shift, the only thing he changed in the case, so he changed the gender, So Heidi to Howard. And then I think in the case, it says I was a cheerleader. And of course, at my age, there were not male cheerleaders in high schools. And so I think he said that Howard was a captain of the football team or something like that. He made some change. And one of the things I've wondered is, I wonder if in the case, because I am a woman in the case, and because I do talk about cooking dinner and hanging out with my kids or bathing my kid. I think there's one point in there where I'm bathing one of my kids in the case. I almost wonder if people didn't go, wow, this Howard guy, he's really kind of in touch with his feminine side. He's pretty cool. And so it isn't that they didn't like me. It's just that they really liked Howard. So, well, maybe it's that. But
That is so interesting.
I do think that we, as women, that we are held to different standards, that we are expected to behave in different ways, and that, you know, every woman has to find her path. And I think some of this is very industry dependent. I think in some industries, you have to be a bone crusher to, you know, like investment banking, where in other industries, I don't think so. I think that I had the opportunity to be a CEO and lead and to now be a board director at many companies, where I can still also have what are stereotypically traditional feminine qualities, right? I can be a collaborator. I can get my point across with self-deprecation and humor. I also do think that I can be very firm and very direct, but still be respectful and kind. I mean, I think you can be all those things at the same time. And so I would like to believe that the world is evolving and that we are more willing to look at people as people first and their gender second. But I also believe that over time I've changed how I behave. I've moderated my behavior to still be effective while at the same time still keeping people comfortable with how I prosecute my work.
This is so interesting, Heidi. Thank you so much for sharing. This, like we were sharing earlier, this has been one of the classics. And like you said, it's been going on for 20 years. Got less to do with the decision-making, like you said, but a lot more on just lifestyle and deciding around it. Mm-hmm. Very interesting on what you share. I think the only element that I keep wondering is that, yes, there are double standards, like you said, and women maybe are expected to behave differently. And yes, we're talking about the VC ecosystem right now, but that applies across the board. Like, because you're a woman, you're expected to behave differently in life. Yeah. And yes, it can prick at times, but I do believe, I think the qualities you mentioned on how you can be effective and direct at the same time, be humble and kind and considerate. I think moving with those qualities should be the way forward almost. And that, like you said, looking at the person first and gender next, almost makes me think that Howard should have incorporated a few additional qualities of Heidi. And like you said, it probably reflected that, where the only things that changed were he was not a cheerleader, but he did have a little bit of a feminine side, if you will. Yes. I almost feel like replacing the feminine style adjective with saying that he had more of a right lifestyle or right personality. Like, being humble is something he was looked upon as, and that's a good thing, and which is how women probably expected by default or something like that. Yeah. But yeah, I think the absolute adjectives of who you are as a person should count a lot more than whether it's you as a woman or a man. And
And by the way, I think some of the men who are great leaders, who I respect the most, are also humble and direct, yeah, but kind and respectful. I mean, I believe those are, they're not confined to the females. I would like all people to lead with those attributes.
Exactly. Super, super interesting. On the same note, would love to hear what advice you'd have for women who are trying to break in and move up in the VC ecosystem, especially like we just discussed on potential biases that may come along the way as they're navigating in. Would love to hear some advice you have for them.
I mean, I think the number one thing, and I think this is a challenge in the current market, is that the market is changing. We had this amazing 12-year bull run. We had a zero interest rate environment. So dollars flowed to VC and the bar was lower, and there's a whole bunch of things that one could do, meaning the bar was lower for what you had to return, because the alternative was put your money in, you know, a 1% CD or something, not even. And so now the market is changing. I think the market, as it always does in these cycles, will contract. And so I think what I'm thrilled about is there are a lot of people who entered VC in the last 5 years who are various diversity types, including women. But I think the problem is you didn't get to form your track record and have that stick. And now we're in a tough market. And I think it's going to be hard to generate liquidity, and it's going to be hard to generate returns. And so hopefully, first of all, the funds that did hire people will have the follow through to be able to last and get through and deliver those returns and allow people to build their track records, because VC is a very long game, slow signal to develop thing. And so one of the worries I have is there are a lot of people, and I won't just say women, and I mean all sorts of anyone who entered the market in the last 5 years is more at risk, because generally speaking, when markets contract, people tend to shed the people who came on most recently. So we'll see, you know, we'll see. But because it does take 5 to 7 years to really build your track record as a VC, you got to have the 5 to 7 years. And frankly, the number one determinant of track records is timing, as much as, yes, there are outliers who are amazing and have done amazing deals, but more or less the number one indicator of it, like a venture fund, the number one indicator of the venture fund's likely return is vintage, right? Is the year it was raised, more than anything else. And so, you know, that is a challenge and a headwind we're facing. I think for any woman to be a VC, and for any person to be a VC, you have to build your track record. And in the meantime, you also have to have some skills that you can deliver to the entrepreneur. So going back to my comment about, you got to be a hunter, right? You got to figure out, what is my thesis? How am I investing? Why am I investing? Why is this market attractive to me right now? What are the drivers of this market? What is going to be the cost to enter the market? What are the potential risks? So you have to be able to analyze a deal to understand if it's attractive to you or not. But then once your money's in the deal, then you completely flip to, how can I make this entrepreneur successful? And what am I going to do to help them? Am I going to help them recruit? Am I going to help them, you know, am I going to serve on the audit committee and serve on the comp committee and serve on the risk committee and do the work of governance that it's there for a reason? It actually is quite helpful. And I, as a VC, also have that extra hat almost always as a company director. What can I do? Can I be their shoulder to cry on? Can I help them avoid mistakes? You know, I often say it's not like I'm telling them what to do, but sometimes I'm sitting there, I'm like, I know you want to put your hand on that stove, but the burner's hot. And if you put your hand on that stove, you're probably going to get burned. You do you, but if you put your hand on that stove, it's going to get burned. And then they put their hand on the stove and it gets burned. And then they come around and they go, oh my God, you told me not to put my hand on the stove. I'm like, yeah. And so next time they're like, hey, Heidi, before I put my hand on that stove, what would you suggest? So, you know, I like to think, again, you know, I have the advantage of age and experience, a lot of it at this point, 40 years of being in the workforce, 40 something years. I'm 65. So 21 minus, yeah, that's a big number. It's a big number. So I've done a lot of this, but that doesn't mean that you as a younger VC don't have the opportunity to build a skill set. I think you're building it every day. I think you're learning every day. I think that focusing on a sector, I think reading every day. I am a huge reader. I read many hours a day, both news as well as books, and reading up on all sorts of things. I think that picking a swim lane, deciding that you're going to be an expert in supply chain, or you're going to be an expert in SaaS models, or you're going to be an expert in even comp. You know, comp is very complicated. Picking the things that entrepreneurs need help with and becoming really good at that is one aspect. And then I think the other aspect does go back really to things about the case is, how do you show up for other people? How are you there for them? How do you make sure that you are always kind, but direct, proactive, not hiding the ball, not lying to people about things? How do you make yourself that person that, you know, one of the things we like to say at Threshold is, for the entrepreneur, we want to be your first call, regardless of whether the news is good or bad, right? That's who we want to be. We want to be the person that as soon as something happens to you, good or bad, you think, I got to call Heidi. And that to me is the sign that we're doing our job, because then we truly are your partner. You know, once the money's in the bank, the money's in the bank. You know, the money is the same no matter who it comes from. I mean, of course, different terms will ultimately affect you, but a dollar's a dollar's a dollar. But the team that comes with it is what really differentiates that, you know, who you take the money from and what value that's going to have to you in the long run. And we want to have that value. And so I think a lot of that just boils down to an attitude and a mentality.
These are some great, insightful and tactical, actually, advice. And I'm sure our listeners will really enjoy it. Heidi, thank you again so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. And keep up the good work.